Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. At the time of Thomas Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase and the popular view of history, the American West was a blank slate, a virtual unknown, unmapped wilderness. That's why we sent Lewis and Clark west to find out exactly what the U.S. government had purchased. Well, it might have been that way to Americans along the eastern seaboard, but my guest today says there were plenty of people and families that knew the West very well and had made a handsome living trading and conducting diplomatic relationships with Native Americans throughout the West for generations. For historian Ann Hyde, a major interest area was how these trading families with names like Choteau, McLaughlin, and Bent integrated their families with Native peoples or Hispanics through intermarriage and children, and how these families interacted and how mixed-race families fared as American civilization, with its rigid social codes and inherent racism, expanded westward. Her book, Empires, Nations, and Families, A History of the North American West, 1800 to 1860, documents the end of the fur trading commercial period in the West and how growing American governmental presence in the West affected these families and their tribal relationships. The book won the prestigious Bancroft Prize in History in 2012, and Ann Hyde is a historian at Colorado College and will be giving the Barnard Lecture in History tonight at 7 o'clock at Gilchrist Museum on what happened to those mixed-race families as America grew westward. Her lecture is titled Hiding in Plain Sight, Mixed Blood Families and Race in 19th Century America. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Gilchrist Museum Auditorium, and the lecture is free and open to the public, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ann Hyde, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick.
I was struck by a term in your book, Empires, Nations, and Families, which might have been some of the formulation for this particular lecture, and it was the notation you found on some obituaries from some rather famous people in the West, in the early West. People like Charles Bent, who was the first U.S. military governor of New Mexico Territory, who said he died single, left no children, even though the story of his death, he was murdered during the Taos Revolt, and he died in the arms of his wife and children.
Which is true, but because his wife was Hispanic, or in the case of his brothers, their wives were Native, they just couldn't show up in various texts that were written at the end of the 19th century, because that would be embarrassing for that upper crust St. Louis family.
Really? Was it just as simple as that? Was there this big divide between how people existed in the West and how they existed in the East as far as cultural taboos, family relationships?
Well, I mean, it's odd because they're, you know, many examples of people who have various kinds of marriages out there, but this kind of racial divide was big. There are, you know, other families where people have wives, several wives, some in St. Louis, some in Kansas City, and then people, you know, wives out in the countryside, and all the wives know about each other too.
Really? So it was polygamy was a part of it?
Yeah. And they educated their children together. I don't know if the wives were happy about it, but it was just a sort of an accepted way of doing business.
Now, in the case of, like, Charles Bent, was he monogamous, or did he have a family in St. Louis?
He did not. The Choteau family is an example of most of the Choteau men had French wives in St. Louis, and then Native wives, usually just one, but sometimes more than one. But often those children kind of cycled in and out of the household in St. Louis. So everybody knew about everybody.
Mm-hmm. But it was just not a topic of polite conversation.
Right.
And when it comes into newspaper accounts upon the obituary. Well, the name of your lecture is Hiding in Plain Sight. So this was pretty accepted practice, and I think until about 1850.
Right. And then the mystery for me is these people exist, and they're all kinds of mixed-race, mixed-blood people, intercultural marriages, whatever term you want to use. But then that category disappears. People stop talking about it as being something that sort of makes the world go round in the West. So now I'm really interested in what happens to them all.
Yeah. Well, take us back to the book picks up with the beginning of the 19th century. And this is the time just prior to the Louisiana Purchase. Yet there are these big networks going on in the West. I think One of the things I come away from the book is that at the time of the Louisiana Purchase, Jefferson and Washington may not have known much about the West, but there was a huge network of trade and diplomacy going on throughout the West, and there were plenty of people who did know the West fairly intimately. It was not like Lewis and Clark. I think they did just sort of bumble their way out West, but there were plenty of people who could have helped them and shown them exactly how to get West.
Well, you can think about the United States as kind of the Johnny come lately in all this. So there are, you know, French, English, Spanish, Mexican, you know, all kinds of people making trade networks out there. And Indian nations are their partners. If you want to do business, you need to have partnerships with Indian nations. And a good way to have partnerships is to have family. So marrying into Indian nations was kind of standard practice.
Mm-hmm. Same in, say, what was then New Spain. If you were an Anglo who came out, you married into a Spanish or Mexican family.
And legally you had to do that. You really couldn't become a citizen without marrying, without becoming Catholic, etc. So it really was, that was the way to do business. And I hate to emphasize the business part, because I think people do have, you know, intimate relationships. It's not just about, oh, I'll get a better business deal if I do this. This was just sort of the families that were available.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in the course of the families that you profile, this was a big part of the business, was to create familial relationships, say the Shotos with the Osage, that helped them build big trading relationships up the Arkansas River, which I was not all that familiar with. I know that the Shoto mission just east of here on the Verdigris or the Grand River, but I didn't know it really went all the way up the Arkansas.
Well, the Shotos are involved all over the place. It's a huge family, and it's a little hard to keep track of because they're all named Auguste or Philippe. So they're, you know, they're a bunch of those guys running around. But up and down the Missouri, far out the Arkansas, there are those Shoto brothers and cousins. The area right around Kansas City is originally Shoto Landing, and that's a different Shoto family, and they're connected with the Shawnee Nation. But again, it's that, you know, the way to do business is to have those kinds of familial relationships with Native nations.
Mm. Now, one of the things you write is that in the Great Lakes, in places like Santa Fe, San Antonio, St. Louis, even what we would consider small towns today like Cape Girardeau or Monterey, California, these were pretty cosmopolitan places at the beginning of the 19th century. I mean, small places, but it was a whole mix of peoples, many languages spoke, and from what you found out, perhaps a mixed race population of 70-80%.
Yeah, some of those cities, well, cities is a sort of loose term, but
yeah, St. Louis was a big village in 1800.
Yeah. But these are, you know, really filled with mixed race people, again, partly because of the fur trade and things like the fur trade. But, you know, doing business with local people was the way to operate. So, you know, part of my argument is that all of this evolves before the state evolves. So the thing that makes the world go round are these big family networks of trade, because the state really had no power in the early 19th century in what we think of as the American West.
So the Indian nations, who did have some power over their particular land, or at least were busy defending it against other tribes and incursions, really were making, having diplomatic relationships with a series of families rather than governments.
And that was familiar turf to everybody. So this kind of smaller scale diplomacy.
It's almost like clan to clan.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. My guest today is Ann Hyde, a historian at Colorado College. She's the author of Empires, Nation, and Families, A History of the North American West, 1800 to 1860, which won the Bancroft Prize in 2012. And she'll be giving the Barnard Lecture in History tonight at 7 o'clock at Gilcrease Museum on Hiding in Plain Sight, Mixed Blood Families and Race in 19th Century U.S. West. Give us some of the ideas of the themes for this evening's talk.
Well, again, using these families, I think this notion of mixed blood people and the shifting meaning of that term over the course of the 19th century, I think, is really interesting. By the end of the 19th century, you can't really be a mixed-blood person, according to the U.S. Census. Now, obviously, I feel silly saying this, in Oklahoma, there are many, many, many mixed-blood people who exist, but they don't have an official category. So what does that transition actually mean over the course of the 19th century? There's some big demographic hole. We don't have any idea how many of those mixed blood people, whatever that term means, there were in the 19th century. So that would be interesting to find out. So that's one of the things I'm interested in. And then how do families make sense of those decisions? Do they decide to be Native? Do they decide to be white? Do they have mixed blood communities and have a different identity around that? So there's a big puzzle about all this.
Well, let me address the latter point. For the most part, did most mixed blood families choose one or the other, or did some have a foot in each culture?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, because I think different families make different choices about this. And the state makes choices for them, too. So in the 1880s, when allotment begins, there's a lot of pressure for people who are mixed blood to either get themselves on the rolls or to make a family gamble and do something different. And some families are successful at this and some families aren't. I think a lot of people manage to, you know, become rural farming people, and you'll see sort of records that say, well, we think maybe their grandma was an Indian or something like that, in those, you know, late 19th century kind of obituary things that we started off talking about. But they're very tied to their native communities still.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and today a lot of times it's about having a foot in one culture and the other at the same time. I would think that society, as the West became more, as Western civilization moved into the West, that became a far more difficult thing to do when it was still what you would say on the Eastern seaboard was wilderness. It was much easier to do.
Well, and the trade relationships were the undergirding of the economy. And when that disappears, so when the fur trade ends, which takes way longer than anybody thinks, but when it really ends, and people need to have a land-based economy, that's kind of when the trouble begins about all this. Who deserves access to land?
Yeah, and I think that's the big story of the Western movement, was that fur trading did not require permanent presence on what were native lands.
Right. Although you really needed knowledge about particular regions and access and all those kinds of things. And a lot of those fur trading groups did have areas where they farmed, you know, in different seasons. So that kind of seasonal round where people did fur trading in the winter and, you know, grew all kinds of crops in the summer is kind of a normal pattern for a lot of those groups.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a big book. I mean, you're taking on a really huge subject, this whole idea of the end of basically the trading system that guided the West. I mean, this is you're describing a lot of the decay of that system. That how long did it go back? I mean, 1700s, even as early as some of the 1600s.
Well, the Hudson's Bay Company, which is the enormous British version of this, is founded in 1670. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not the first thing. So the French fur traders are out there earlier than that. So this is 300 years worth of this system, which was a partnership between native people and all kinds of Europeans. And not always a happy partnership and not always a peaceful one, but they needed each other.
So give us a sense of how you put this book together and sort of what the parameters were for describing the family part of it versus this ending fur empire as it and the emerging national empire.
Well, the family piece was really accidental. I was kind of given the assignment of describing the American West between 1800 and 1860, and that sort of scared me. So I started.
And let me stop you by saying that the publisher was really wanting sort of a new assessment of
right.
this period.
And the more I looked, the more I kept seeing all of these mixed blood families as being at the center of this Western story. Now, again, you have to remember, and this is hard for us to remember, that it wasn't a done deal that the United States would have control over what we think of as the American West in 1800. So it was very clear that Britain, France, and Spain were the people who were controlling the situation. So the notion that it's going to turn out to belong to the United States sort of isn't engraved in stone at that moment. So watching the new United States kind of make sense of this landscape and then kind of gradually, maybe the term is metabolize it, is kind of the heart of the book.
And of course, even after the Louisiana Purchase, it's not necessarily guaranteed because you have the English to the north and you profile another family, which probably unknown to us here in most of the United States, the McLaughlin family. This was a English-Canadian fur trading empire that I guess went all the way to the Pacific coast from the Great Lakes.
Right, and he's married to a Cree woman, and so they have a large brood of mixed blood children. And again, this is really typical, even for the most elite members in the fur trade industry.
Mm-hmm. Now, you focused on that family. You also focused on the Choteau family, and the Choteau family were French. And I think the first scene in the book is the family matriarch as she's watching the French tricolor come down and the United States flag go over St. Louis after the announcement of the purchase. This family was had trade networks all over the West.
So, you know, they're married into the Osage, they're married into Shawnees, Delawares, Kansas Indians. So it's, you know, they understand that that's how you do business. And they do that for a couple of generations.
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of how far their networks extended.
You could probably take them all the way to, all these guys know each other. So John McLaughlin, who works for the Hudson's Bay Company, writes letters to the Choteau family in St. Louis. So, you know, they're doing business together around the business of fur, and they kind of lobby together. But the Choteaus, in their large family network, all the way up the Mississippi River into Canada, all the way south into what's now Oklahoma, Arkansas, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And basically every river that's running off the Mississippi, they're sending scouts or family members, really, to establish trading posts.
Well, the American Fur Company, which is the sort of old Choteau family that runs really until the 1860s, is enormous. So hundreds and hundreds of employees.
Mm-hmm. My guest today is Ann Hyde. She'll be giving the Barnard Lecture tonight at Gilchrist Museum at 7 o'clock on Hiding in Plain Sight, Mixed Blood Families and Race in 18th Century America and the West. And in it, you profile a number of communities. St. Louis is one, which we've talked about. It's what is now Mackinac Island. I can't say the Michilimackinac.
Michilimackinac.
Michilimackinac, which was the fort where Mackinac Island is. Or Mackinac Island, I guess, is where was an extensive trade network that brought in all the furs from the Great Lakes. You also talk about Santa Fe and the society there. Santa Fe is like, it's what, the capital of the northern part of New Spain since, 1600s? So this was a thriving community there, or
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, Santa Fe is founded in 1612. There are missions there. There's so up and down the Rio Grande River, you know, all kinds of native communities that are intermixed with this, you know, Spanish colonial settlers. So that's an old standing pattern. Santa Fe is the sort of farthest northern border. It really isn't big business until the early 19th century when the Santa Fe trade opens up legally. Of course, there have been people trading there for a long time illegally. But once that trade is opened up, the Spanish and then the Mexican government are much more interested in it because there's this, you know, they're now tied into St. Louis, New Orleans, et cetera.
And that's the Bent family.
Mm-hmm.
Bent family came west from St. Louis, came down the Santa Fe Trail and basically opened trade that would extend throughout the Rocky Mountain West, or at least a good part of the Rocky Mountain West.
Yeah, all over the, you know, what's now the Rio Grande drainage, the Arkansas drainage, et cetera. Bent's Fort is right on the Arkansas is a lot smaller than it is here, where Bent's Fort is. It's a little tiny creek-looking thing there, but that was a central trading zone for 30 or 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Talk about their family relationships. I mean, did it involve both Hispanic as well as Native Americans?
Well, Charles Bend, who lived in Taos and had been a trader there for a long time, he becomes the first Anglo governor of New Mexico after the war. But he'd been married to a Hispanic woman, the Jaramillo family, for 20 years, has a large family, is very interconnected. His brothers are married to Native women. William Bent, who's the operator of the Big Bent's Fort, marries into the Southern Cheyenne. Mm-hmm. And he marries a woman and her sister, and they have five children between the two women.
Mm-hmm. Well, so as the West changes and sort of national considerations sort of take over these informal relationships, what happens to these families as far as these mixed race families, and what happens to their descendants? Do they lose their status as sort of American government moves in, or what exactly?
Well, that's a really excellent question, and I'm really trying to sort that out now. I mean, you could use the Bents maybe as an example. Those children who are from this very elite family are sent to elite St. Louis boarding schools. They go to Jesuit colleges. The two sons serve in the Civil War, and in spite of that, they are marked as mixed race people after the Civil War, and sort of logically, that with the Southern Cheyenne who end up in Oklahoma, they end up there too. But they're kind of, not all of them do that. There are some other sisters who marry white men and who stay in Southern Colorado, kind of pass, but there's the very complicated mixed race community in the late 19th century in Southern Colorado along the Arkansas River.
So some would be ostracized based on their physical appearance? Would it be something like that?
Some of it is gender. I think it's much harder for men who are mixed blood men and are marked as Native in the late 19th century to marry white women, whereas women who are mixed blood, especially if they have, Bent property and status,
which becomes, as we have to remember, that's their it's chattel at this point as far as a marriage relationship.
Right.
It all goes
that's
to
right.
the man. Yeah.
So girls do better in this situation, which again is very interesting.
Mm. My guest today is Ann Hyde, a historian at Colorado College. She's the author of Empires, Nations, and Families, which won the Bancroft Prize, and she'll be giving the Barnard Lecture on one aspect of this big, large book, which is about 600 pages and details a whole string of stories of these families who sort of created these trading and diplomatic relationships with Native tribes and with Spanish authorities as well, and his Mexican authorities at the beginning of the 19th century. But she'll be speaking on the idea of these mixed blood families. Has this spurred further research? It sounds like you have some more questions coming out of this this big book than you maybe had going in.
That's what always happens. So now I'm curious about what happens to these families in the late 19th century when the racial boundaries get stiffer. So I'm tracking it. So for the talk, I'm talking about two of these families. What happens to that McLaughlin-McKay family in the Pacific Northwest, and then a Missouri River family called the Drips, mm-hmm. who have a really interesting
now, what
history.
What a part of the Missouri River? Are we talking upper Missouri or?
It's right where the Missouri turns north. So it's where Kansas City is today. They end up on something that's actually called a half-breed tract that were special chunks of land created for these children of fur traders. And there are quite a few of those things around.
Half-breed tracts.
I know that the words kind of make your hair stand on end in the 21st century, but it was a solution. What do we do about these children?
Because the tribes weren't claiming them, was it sort of like they were in no man's land for?
No, the tribes were very willing to. They were worried that they were going to lose out because they weren't tribal members. So as the sort of specter,
so basically, the tribes set aside land for
yes,
them.
Yes, they did.
Interesting.
Because they wanted that group of people to be included in their population.
And the Drips in the Missouri, what were their connections?
Andrew Drips, who's one of the old time fur trapper guys, marries an Oto woman in the 1820s, and her name is Macompame. They have a bunch of children, and then when she dies, he marries a Dakota woman, and they have a bunch more children. So, like, over 30 years, there's this, you know, generation of these children that you can really track.
Mm. Well, that sounds like a really interesting. Are you actively researching this now? Or?
Yep, and that's been really, really fun, because I usually do early 19th century stuff, and now I have photographs of people. And, you know, with Ancestry.com and those more sort of public sites, people send me all of their pictures of their relatives, and I never get to do that in the early 19th century.
Now given, I mean, I would think that's the hard part about tracing this, is because you look at an obituary like of Charles Benton. He says he's, you know, single, no children, yet you know he has a family, and yet the public sources, the easy researchable material, is not going to acknowledge that family.
Right. So you have to look at church records, you have to look at family letters, you have to look at trader's licenses. That sounds like the most boring thing on earth, but all of these men had to put their children's names on all of these licenses to go out and trade with native groups. So you can find, you know, so a few ways you can find people.
Wow.
And their relatives help me all the time.
Well, we wish you a great success. Are you working on a book on what happens to these families?
Yep.
All right. What's the timeline at this point?
Kind of 1850 to about 1910 mm-hmm. is the time period I'm looking at. I keep edging further into the 20th century, which makes me nervous.
Yeah, well, by this time, I mean, the race codes are incredibly rigid, I would think.
And still they're there. So that's the title, you know, mm-hmm. Hiding in Plain Sight.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success with that project. We look forward to the lecture tonight at Gilcrease at 7. Anne Hyde, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Colorado College historian Anne Hyde speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's the author of Empires, Nations, and Families, A History of the North American West, 1800 to 1860, which is now out in paperback from HarperCollins, which won the 2012 Bancroft Prize and was a Pulitzer finalist. She'll be giving the Barnard Distinguished Lecture in History for the University of Tulsa this evening at 7 at the Gilcrease Museum Auditorium, speaking on Hiding in Plain Sight, Mixed Blood Families, and Race in 19th Century America. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.